Willkommen bei einer neuen Episode von Markenkraft. Für alle, die von Marken fasziniert und für ihr Wohlergehen verantwortlich sind. Welcome to Markenkraft. My name is Olaf Hartmann and today we have another episode exploring the psychological mechanics behind real brand power. How expectations, memories and small sensory signals influence our perception of brands and our behavior, much more than we realize. Today I'm joined by someone who has done tremendous work to bring clarity to this space and make the science applicable to everyday marketing decisions, Richard Schotten. He's founder of the consultancy Astroton, advising Fortune 500 brands. He is an associate of the Moller Institute, Churchill College, Cambridge University, and an honorary fellow of the IPA, the Institute of Practitioners in Advertising. Richard is the author of the best-selling books, The Choice Factory, The Illusions of Choice, and most recently, and that's why we speak today, with Michael Aaron Flicker, he wrote Hacking the Human Mind, uncovering the behavioral science patterns behind 17 of the world's most powerful brands. His core message is simple and still uncomfortable for some. People are not as rational as we think. We are not rational decision machines. They are emotional, biased, seemingly inconsistent, and nevertheless, wonderfully predictable. If you know how the brain processes the world around it. And that's exactly why behavioral science isn't just an add-on to brand communication. It delivers guiding principles for designing brand experience. Because every touchpoint is, at heart, a psychological intervention with the goal to make us feel, think, and ultimately, do something. Richard, I've been looking forward to this and it's a pleasure to have you on Markenkraft.
It's very nice to be here. Thanks for the invite.
Wonderful. And let's first, before we dive into all the interesting science and how to hack human minds, let's dive into your mind before. So before we learn how to hack others. And just to get to know you a little bit for my German listeners, I'm sure many know you, but in the English-speaking world, you are a superstar of behavioral science, and we're working on improving that in the German-speaking world. Are the books translated, by the way?
They are. So they're across 16 languages.
Oh, wonderful.
German isn't one of them yet, but it is in the pipeline. So the German edition, The Choice Factory, should be out reasonably soon.
Wonderful.
I mean, it's a slight travesty that there's no German yet because there are far smaller countries, Czech, Mongolian, Hungarian, all sorts. But yeah, not German quite yet.
Okay, so this podcast imparts secret knowledge. So competitive advantage, that's great.
Exactly.
About you, like, where did you grow up and what was the first money you earned and what did you spend it on? So three questions in one.
The first one's easy. So I grew up in Essex, which is kind of 40 miles northeast of the centre of London. And a little bit of a rural area where I grew up. So my first ever money was working for a nearby farmer. And I went with my older brother and we would bag their horse manure and take it down to the bottom of their drive so they could sell it. And my main memory...
Multi-sensory work.
My main memory is me being slightly uncoordinated, my brother getting very, very annoyed as I would be trying to get the manure into the bag that he was holding open. It would generally go down his front. So I don't think we lasted that long. I think he drew an end to the partnership quite quickly. That must have been, I don't know, I was probably 10 when I did that, very young. So I've not really any idea where I spent the money. But knowing me, I probably would have saved it. I was always one for kind of squirreling things away and hoarding stuff. So I think the highly likely truth is that I didn't spend it on anything.
That's interesting. So that leads us to a question. Did you remember a moment when you did spend money and a brand influenced you on that spending?
Ooh. Wow, that's a very good point. So very hard to say what ads have affected me, but I certainly wouldn't try and deny that I have been influenced. I would struggle to think about one of the first times though. Probably if you go back to the childhood, it would have been spending on, if I did spend anything on cassettes and LPs. I'm showing my age here now. Yeah. I think the first...
TDK cassettes.
TDK, yeah, so recording stuff off your mate's tapes. I think Appetite for Destruction, Guns N' Roses, was the first album I ever bought. So that might have been...
That's also a brand. You know, bands are brands, huh?
Like, yeah, fair point.
The big brands, they usually code themselves also very well. It's like if you think about it, huh?
Even the ones that claim to be about authenticity.
Yeah,
it's an amazing podcast called Rest Is History, and of course, you know, British podcasters. So there's an awful lot of British history, 1066, Napoleonic Wars, all sorts of things. But they also do a lot of cultural stuff. And one of the last ones I listened to was about the Rolling Stones. And there seems to be an active decision to turn themselves into a brand, almost defined in opposition to the clean-cut Beatles. They were going to be the rebellious, tough, streetwise band. Whereas actually, the reality is quite different. You know,
it was the opposite, huh? Like the Beatles were actually coming from working class backgrounds and really rough on stage in Hamburg, and the Rolling Stones had more like a middle class background and.
Absolutely, yeah. Mick Jagger went to the LSE. And it was very hard. You know, 1960s, tiny 20% of people went to university, let alone to a very prestigious one like London School of Economics. Yeah, a lot of them had very, quiet backgrounds. But they realised that wasn't a position that was already taken by the Beatles. They defined themselves in opposition. I think it was the kind of Lou Gold and the manager who thought this was the niche that they could exploit. So I think you're right. A lot of the bands, even if they pretend otherwise, are brands in essence.
The band Rammstein, for example, is a great example of great branding. If you just do a Google search and visuals and you immediately see there's a recognizable stage design, all the symbols, everything is just, it's very well branded. And how did you get into work with brands, advertising? Tell us a little bit about your professional background.
So professional background, very much marketing first, behavioral science second. When I was at school, when I was at university, I'd never even considered psychology. Behavioral science, I don't think, was ever an option. But I'd always been interested, in retrospect, looking back and thinking about all the choices I made in terms of subjects. I was always interested in why people did the things they did. So I A-levels, I did English, history, geography and history of art. English is essentially stories about people, why people do the things they do. Geography, how behavior varies by space, history, how it varies over time, history of art, you know, the stories behind why people do things, you know, captured in art. So there was always this thread of being really, really interested in why people do the things they do. And then frankly, once you've finished university, there aren't many jobs where people will pay you to follow an interest in a hobby. And I thought, well, this is amazing. I know people's commercial behavior is only a sliver of all the decisions they make, but I think it's an interesting microcosm. And the fact that someone will pay me to sit around and think about some of these questions, you know, why people buy the thing they do, why people pay premiums for items that are essentially the same. You know, I thought that was a great opportunity.
Right. That's interesting because you just phrased one of the basic behavioral science principles that context shapes behavior. And what you just described is, I didn't think about that. Yeah, geography is context and it shapes behavior. Yeah, like the historical moment when things happen, it shapes behavior. And there are windows of opportunities where people behave a certain way and achieve a lot, and then they behave the same way and the window isn't there and nothing happens. I never thought of it like that.
And also, even at the time, I don't think I was really thinking of it that way. I just did the four subjects I really enjoyed. Mm-hmm. And it was very much with geography. It was always the human geography side. You know, I really did struggle through Oxbow Lakes. And
then you started to work in advertising or marketing on the client side?
I was always at an agency, but I started as a media planner.
A media planner.
Okay. Yes. So advising companies on where to spend their money, and then eventually moved into research and then specialized in behavioral science.
Right. And when did you encounter behavioral science? What was there the moment where the term actually, it was probably wasn't around by the time you studied?
Absolutely. So like most things in life, I think you normally just drift into them, and it's very hard to say that there is a specific moment. But for me, behavioral science was a bit different. I can remember very, very clearly when I kind of got the bug 2004. Mm-hmm. I was responding, you know, as a team member on a brief from the Department of Health in Britain. So we were trying to encourage people to give blood. And I just so happened to be reading The Tipping Point by Malcolm Gladwell. And although most of the book is about completely different topics, there is, I think, about half a page right at the back of the book where he describes a 1960s experiment by two American psychologists called Latané and Daly into an idea called the bystander effect. Now, the bystander effect is essentially the finding that if you ask lots of people for help, there is a diffusion of responsibility and everyone leaves it up to someone else. Now, when I read that description of the experiment and the results, I thought to myself, well, you know, gosh, this is exactly the problem that we face. The Department of Health goes out, asks everyone in England to give blood. And just as Latané and Daly suggest, most people say, well, I'll leave it up to my neighbour. It sounds a bit painful. It sounds too much hassle. So I can remember going along, meeting up with the creative agency and saying, look, I've read this study. Why don't we try and avoid this bystander effect? Why don't we, instead of saying blood stocks are low in England, why don't we minimise this diffusion of responsibility, create a sense of personal responsibility, and instead ask people in Basildon or Brentford, you know, small towns, to give blood. So rather than saying blood stocks are low in England, we tested saying blood stocks are low in Brentford.
Okay, so your personal, like one of the recommendations is like, if you're in trouble and you have a heart attack and nobody helps, it's like, you with the blue jacket and the blonde hair, help me. Yeah? And yeah. And then suddenly you break the surface tension.
Yeah, exactly. And also, you know, the person with the blonde hair and the blue jacket is probably paralyzed by not knowing what to do in your setting. And they think, well, look, these other people around me, you know, they probably know what they can do. I'll leave it up to them. So I think there's a very similar analogy there. And your example, I think, is pretty far close to what Latané and Daly were interested in. But I kind of thought, well, look, it's a bit of a leap, but we can still apply this to creative. So very crude change. They just stopped saying blood stocks low in England, started saying blood stocks low in Birmingham or London. But even that crude change had a very positive effect. It was something of the order of a 10 or 15% improvement when we got the results in terms of the cost per response. Hmm. And I can remember thinking at the time, you know, this is amazing. You know, we've taken this 1960 study, applied it to creative, and we've seen this positive effect.
And such a small difference. It's just
tiny
difference.
Exactly. Yeah. And it got me thinking, well, okay, this is one study. What else is it there out there? And I was shocked that there were hundreds, thousands of studies completely available to anyone who wanted to look them up. Yet back in 2004, it was certainly in my experience, completely ignored in the agency world. Mm. And I thought this was a crying shame. Why weren't we building on the work of academics? You know, why weren't we applying findings from behavioral science when it just seemed so relevant to what we were trying to do?
Right, right. But that's a reoccurring theme on this podcast that we talked about a lot already, that we seem to be one of the few industries that don't build on what was there before. There's no systematic development of knowledge. It's like everybody feels obliged to reinvent the wheel in the new generation. It's like the newest thing. And this is a great example of like old studies. If they are robust, they are, you know, we talk about that later as well.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. Because a study's been conducted does not mean that the study was conducted well. They're different things, absolutely. We need to be careful to draw on the more robust findings. Completely agree with that.
Yeah, but like what you just did is like you challenge assumptions that people, like, can this really make a difference? You know, that people make decisions consciously and rationally. And this is an example that they don't. And why is this assumption still so dominant in brand leadership? Like, and what does it cost the brands? It's like even in the last 15 years with performance marketing and everything happening out there, there seems to be that mental model, we need to convince people, you know, push them into buying. And this is another thing. We need to change the context in which they make the decision.
I think it's a myth that sticks around for two reasons. Firstly, because it seems plausible and sensible. Now, surely if someone is buying a car or a mobile phone, and it's an expensive thing, they should be weighing up all the information. It seems plausible. And then the second reason why I think the kind of myth of the calculating machine as consumer remains is that we rely far too much as an industry on claims data. So the standard way of working out why people buy things is to send them a survey, to run a focus group. But a theme of behavioral science is what people say and what actually motivates them. They are very, very different things. Sometimes because the respondent straight out lies, that is an issue. But the far bigger problem, both in terms of scale and difficulty of overcoming it, is that often people don't know why they do the things they do. So psychologists have this phrase, they say people confabulate. They try and tell the truth, but because they don't know their own motivations, they end up misleading. So if you put someone on the spot in a focus group or a survey, now they'll give you lots of answers. They'll try and be helpful, but those answers often send you off in the wrong direction. And I think that reliance on claimed data, often people who are taking part in a survey will paint themselves as very sensible, rational, considered thinkers. So if you rely on surveys, yeah, your advertising, your marketing will always head off in that direction.
Mm. Why did you buy that Porsche? Yeah, because of great consumption, doesn't decrease much in value. In the end, I want to look good when I get out of the car in front of a restaurant.
Yeah.
It's like, but nobody says that in the survey. It's like, I just want to look good when I get out of the car in front of the restaurant.
Exactly, because I think it would transgress some of our cultural beliefs in that, oh, well, if you're going to spend that much money, it should be a thoughtful, deep, considered thing. But actually, underneath it all, there are all these swirling massive emotions, memories from when you were a child, your favorite James Bond movie, maybe you drive some kind of a model that you want to ape later on. Yeah, right. But people self-select, I think, part of the reasons that are actually affecting them. And they just report back on the ones that make them look like a sensible, plausible decision maker.
So we have a problem here in the data, the mental model, basically.
I think that's probably any complex question, multiple reasons, but one of the biggest is this reliance on claimed data. Right. So yeah, if anyone starts to feel interested in any of the principles we talk about, run a simple experiment. Don't ask people.
Great. So let's do this structurally. Give us, because you've done that in one of your books, I don't know, in the last one, but you said like, okay, if this is the first time that my listeners, they're responsible for a brand, they never really, they always heard something about Kahneman, like thinking fast and slow and so, but they never really applied it. So now let's do the pitch. Why does behavioral science, why is it so important for brand management?
Okay.
What are the reasons?
So the first thing is, if you've never heard of behavioral science, leave thinking fast and slow well alone. Kahneman, I think, made the joke himself that lots of people buy his book, not many people read it. So I think that might be the first piece of advice. But more sensibly, what is behavioral science? Well, we said earlier, look, this is the study of what actually influences people. And I would argue if you work in marketing, whatever subdiscipline, whatever category, that is something that is relevant to you as a marketer. Now, as a marketer, you're in the business of behavior change. The core questions you deal with every day, let's get people to switch brands. Let's get people to pay a premium. Let's get people to buy more of our products. Now, all of those questions are questions of behavior change. So really the question should be, why wouldn't you draw on 130 years of what makes for effective behavior change? Now, that's all behavioral science is. And the way it gets to the answers is robust because it doesn't rely on what people say influences them. Instead, the building blocks of this subject are experiments. Now, simple, naturalistic A-B experiments that unearth insights about human nature that can be put to practical use.
Hmm. That's a convincing pitch, I think. And even we could even say brand itself is a behavioral science principle because it's a prime. I perceive the brand and then suddenly I perceive whatever the brand offers in a different light. We can come back to that later, but in the end, the ultimate goal of managing a brand is creating a behavioral science effect.
Yeah, let's say you are a beer marketer What you really want is a powerful brand, which if someone drinks your beer in a branded glass, knowing it's your product, they will think it's tastier than if they drink it in an unbranded glass without knowing what it is. You know, a lot of beer marketers will have done that testing, and you know, it's evidence that we, not completely, but we partially taste what we expect to taste. I mean, there's all sorts of studies around that. There's one, for example, by Baba Shiv at Stanford, where he looks at the brand effect on taste, but the price effect on taste. So gets a group of Americans, serves them five different bottles of wine. The emphasis is different bottles of wine. Actually, one of the liquids is repeated. And on the bottles, there is a very prominent price label. So the main bit of the experiment is sometimes people will drink a Merlot thinking it comes from a $5 bottle. Later on, they'll take a sip from the same wine, but it's in a different bottle and it's labeled costing $45. Now, when people give their taste ratings, there is a 70% difference in ratings. You know, people far prefer the liquid when it comes out of that supposedly expensive bottle. Now, what Shiv argues is we, to a degree, we taste what we expect to taste. And price is one of the things that sets a positive expectation. Because generally in life, expensive things taste better. That becomes a bit of a self-fulfilling prophecy. And those expectations will affect the end taste.
Right. So I think we've established that it's worth to continue talking.
I hope so.
For anybody who's responsible for brands. And what I really enjoyed your first books. Like there are, I don't know the exact number, I think 360 identified behavioral science principles or something. You probably know it more precisely.
Well, I mean, it's...
Whatever.
It's like saying how many shades of color are. It kind of depends where you draw the lines.
Yeah. Exactly. But in the first books, you picked out the most valuable ones and always gave suggestions how this could be applied, or sometimes you also described how it was applied. But in your new book, which I liked very much, you turned it around. You basically said, okay, here, look, these are the strongest brands in the world. And now let's look at these brands through the lens of behavioral science. And I think that was very good because it makes it immediately apparent that each of these brands, and it's not the complete explanation of their success, to be fair, but a large part of their success has been helped by applying these principles. So why don't we dive in that? Because it makes it, for anybody out there listening, very tangible. Why did you decide to turn around the perspective? What was there some experience that you made in applying behavioral science, and what did you find?
Okay. So two reasons. The first reason was when I had been talking about the first two books, The Choice Factor and The Illusion of Choice, what I'd often do is take an audience through, you know, maybe a training session or a talk. I'd take them through an experiment, explain the methodology, give them results. I would then talk about the implications and then give some examples of people applying these principles. So, you know, maybe 5 or 6 minutes on the pratfall effect or social proof, then an explanation and then a few examples of people using it. And what I found again and again was you would often have blank faces during the explanation of the study, but the penny would drop, the light bulb would go off when I started giving examples of brands using these principles. So what it made me realize was sometimes the discussion of the experiments can be a little bit abstract and people can struggle with that. But once you ground the explanation in the story of a brand that people are very familiar with, it's much easier to them to understand. So that was one reason, just I think simplicity of understanding. And then the second part was I had this memory of when I worked at an agency. And when we would get a brief in from a client, we would always try and get inspiration by looking around at what other really successful brands did in the category or in a related category. And it always seemed like a very good approach for generating ideas. But you realize after a while it's a bit flawed, because if you look to, I don't know, Amazon or Uber or Tesla to try and learn great marketing tactics, what you very quickly realize is all these successful brands are very, very complex. They do hundreds of things and they do hundreds of things at the same time. So it's quite hard to unpick what actually powered their success and what things were done just at the same time and had no impacts either way. So what we do with each of the 17 brands in Hacking the Human Mind is we pick 17 very successful brands, look at all the things they do, and then we overlay this lens of behavioral science. And we think of all the great things that Amazon Prime or Haagen-Dazs or wherever have done, which are the tactics or strategies that have also been proven to work in peer-reviewed controlled experiments. And what that hopefully does is identify the genuine ingredients that power these successful brands, rather than just superfluous behaviours that happen to be done by successful brands. And so hopefully it means that it's easier for marketers to pick up the magic ingredients that are powering success rather than redundant elements.
That's very good. It's like looking at a successful person and not imitate him wearing a certain watch or driving a certain car, but knowing what he has done before to be able to afford these two things. Because big brands do a lot because they have a lot of money. They can do a lot, and not everything is effective. So what was the basic principle? So it makes a lot of sense. So let's just dive in to make it tangible for everybody out there. I have some favorites, but maybe I leave the choice to you. What would you like to? What is your favorite brand to talk about from the book?
I think maybe one of the favorites is Apple. I'm a big fan of Apple, partly because we probably could have done a book just about
only
Apple.
On Apple. Yeah, they have been applying all the behaviors.
They do seem to repeatedly use.
But supposedly they never researched anything. That's also a big myth of Steve Jobs. Always said I just got this vision and we just do these things. And then when they were with Samsung in court, they had to release all this research that they have done. They research every little detail. So you're right. Yeah. You probably could apply all the behavioral science principles to Apple. Let's do it.
So with Apple, one of the kind of moments that we discuss is the launch of the iPod, and they had this aim of conveying memory and storage. That's essentially the reason you buy an iPod. And what most of the competitors did was talk about things like 256 megabytes of memory. Now, that's what Philips did. That's what Sony did. They conveyed memory and storage in very abstract terms. What Apple did was something very, very different. Now, they talked about 1,000 songs in your pocket. So exactly the same aim of conveying storage, but they used language that people could visualize. You can picture a pocket. You can imagine a song. And that taps into a very well-known behavioral science principle called concreteness. So essentially, this is the argument, goes back to the work of Ian Begg, 1972, psychologist at University of Western Ontario. And what he did was recruit a group of people, read out a list of 22 word phrases. And half of the phrases he read out were what he called abstract phrases. These are intangible concepts like impossible amount or subtle fault. The other half of the phrases he read out were what he called concrete phrases. These are physical, tangible items. So phrases like white horse or square door. And what Begg found was that on average, people remembered 9% of the abstractions, but 36% of the concrete phrases. So there is this massive fourfold difference in memorability. According to Begg, vision's the most powerful of our senses. And if you use language that people can visualize, it sticks in their mind. If you use language people can't visualize, it's very, very forgettable. So Philips talking about 256 megabytes, very abstract, completely forgettable. Apple talking about 1,000 songs in your pocket, because they're creating this mental image, this thing you can picture, it's a message people can remember 20 years later. So that was one of the campaigns that I absolutely love with Apple.
I love it. I can associate with what you just described, because it also uses more of our brain, because those memories, our motorical cortex, is like 40% of our brain. If we give stimulus to that, then obviously our brain is more activated, and then later on we will remember it better because it was more activated. And so with language, what I take from this as a takeaway is like to create multisensory stimulations by language. Not only works in real multisensory stimulations, but also in language. Make it tangible, make it concrete. So that's a great example.
Yeah, and it's an example that far, far more brands could apply. You know, if you pick up today's newspaper, flick through it, I would wager that the vast majority of those ads will be using highly abstract language. They'll be talking about things like, we're quality, we are premium, we're trustworthy. Concepts that people can understand, but the concepts they can't visualize. And it's this key thing of visualization. So what you really want to be doing is think like Apple, fine to have an objective of quality or premiumness or trustworthiness. But when you select the language that you're actually going to communicate, make sure you translate those concepts into visualizable things. So, another example, Red Bull didn't say Red Bull gives you energy. It said Red Bull gives you wings.
That's more concrete.
Yeah. Yeah. Wings is something you can picture. Energy is too abstract to imagine.
Or even stay a little moment with Apple, still a little longer, just the way they present their products also on screen. If you go to the website, these really strong close-ups, there was like a certain visual language, which made you almost like the products jumped out of the screen, like without using, they also used words to describe things like in a very sensory way, but also made you simulate like as if you could touch it. Yeah, the way that the cameras and all those animations in the website. So this caters to the principle you just explained.
I think they are a brand that, you know, so many of the things they do, you know, I think reference multiple behavioral science principles. But yeah, that's just one of the
one more that you like. One more from Apple, like which you like.
Well, the other one we talk about is the idea of optimal newness. So it's this idea that essentially people have got these competing feelings, like a kind of neophobia and a neophilia. So we both fear the new because it brings risk, but we are drawn to it because it might bring opportunity. So there's a number of different studies that suggest that the sweet spot is optimal newness. And it's a little bit different, but it's not completely revolutionary. That's what we're drawn to. So there's a wonderful book called The Hitmakers by Derek Thompson. And he essentially sums up this phrase by saying, you know, to sell something familiar, make it surprising. To sell something surprising, make it familiar. Now, you take that insight and you go and look at the history of the iPhone and you see Apple have not just been masters of applying that idea once, they have evolved it over time. So when the iPhone first launched, it was a very strange technology. It was a radically new technology for most people. Now, I know technologists might say, well, other people had developed many of these features. That may be true. But for most of the purchasers, it was the first time they were experiencing, you know, touch screens and all of these things brought together in a mobile phone. So what Apple did was try and make this radically new technology feel as familiar as possible. So, for example, you go back to those very early days and the designers used a technique called skeuomorphism, which is giving real world representations of features. So, for example, the delete function was a picture of a waste paper bin. The notes function looked like a yellow legal pad. The script that it wrote in was akin to handwriting. You tore off a page and it left like a little jaggedy edge at the top. Everything looked like their real world equivalents. That was there to try and make it more familiar. But then over time, you know, as the iPhone becomes accepted, we're on our, you know, multiple second, third, fourth ownership of the product. That need to make it familiar evaporates. It's already, the technology is becoming far better known. And over time, the designers drop skeuomorphism and they start using icons that are far more abstract in their representation. So, even little things like that, I think Apple were fantastic.
That's a great example. Mm. I remember the first time that I saw the date function where you put the dates in, it this little wheel which was like turning and gave this little sound like we call it Kirmes, I don't know how you call it, a fair, like those lotteries where you have this little rubber thing that is going around the wheel and when it ends up in a certain number, you win something, yeah? This sound, you know, like, so yeah. It made it very playful, almost felt like a lottery that I'm playing, putting in my a date in the calendar.
And that's a lovely example because I jumped very much to the kind of visual icons. But I think you're right. A lot of the other elements of the phone, things like sound, try to make that same comparison. So with your photo app, you know, when you clicked it, there would be a noise as if a shutter had just gone off. And there's no actual need for that sound, but people found it reassuring because it was akin to the handheld camera they'd been used to.
And it activates memory, which is also related to touch. You know, like the clicking of the sound comes from mechanic parts being pressed down, and then there's a resistant, and then the mirror in the camera goes up and down, and that's all physical. And I think that's very powerful. Also, Apple, like you just described, also taught us how to pet our phone. And that is like that's the completely new way of interacting with the phone that changes the relationship. But we take away from this, I think you've described it very well. It's like, okay, we got something new. We got to make sure that we have enough elements that people will recognize and connect with also emotionally to something that they know and that they feel familiar with. And then we have the powerful for innovation. That's a very good insight.
Yeah, and the idea with the book is not just to say, you know, Apple use this technique of skeuomorphism, you should copy it. Mm-hmm. It's trying to get to the underlying reason why that was useful at that particular moment. Mm-hmm. And you're absolutely right. Every reader of the book has to ask themselves the question, you know, is my product genuinely groundbreaking and surprising? If so, let's think of ways of making it more familiar. Or is it quite humdrum? Therefore, we want to spice it up with that dash of surprisingness.
Right.
And it requires the marketer to have an honest reflection on their product.
Yeah. And you already mentioned Red Bull, another superpower brand. Everybody is in awe of their success. They have followed many, many rules. I think that, let's talk about Red Bull. What did you see in Red Bull? Which behavioral science principles were most powerful?
And for each chapter, we talk about two or three different principles. But I think the one that has the broadest relevance to the most marketers is the idea of price relativity. So essentially, price relativity is the suggestion that when people are judging what a fair price to pay for something is, what they don't do, because it's too complex, is think, how many units of benefit am I going to get from this product? And then use a kind of universal yardstick to calculate what a fair value would that be. You know, let's say they're prepared to pay €1 per unit of benefit. So what people tend to do, and this is something that Kahneman talks about, is when they're faced with a complex question, they tend to replace that complex question with a simpler one that gives them an almost as good answer. So the complex question would be working out, well, how much utility do I get from products? And then translating that into your kind of fair amounts paid per unit of benefit. The simpler question is, what have I paid for something similar? And if this new item is more, it's bad value. If this new item is less, it's good value. Now, this idea that valuation, our willingness to pay, is relative rather than absolute, has massive implications for marketers. Because what it suggests is, if you can change the mental comparison set for your product, you can change people's willingness to pay by orders of magnitude. Now, Red Bull did that brilliantly. And this is something Rory Sutherland points out in his wonderful book, Alchemy. Now, 100 marketers launched this product. What I think 99 would have done would be put Red Bull in a squat, cylindrical can that looked much like a Coke can. But if they'd done that, the comparison set for Red Bull would have been cans of Coke, cans of Fanta. And the pound or the €1.50 they wanted to charge at launch would have looked astronomically expensive compared to the 33 cents that Coke were charging. But paradoxically, by making the can smaller, but stretching that can into this tall cylinder, you make it a completely different category from other soft drinks, and you allow people's willingness to pay to run free. So a core insight here, it is for marketers to think to themselves, what would be the ideal comparison set for my product? And then think about ways of creating that comparison rather maybe than the more natural one.
Right. Okay. So what we take from this is think like the point of sale is the head of your customers, and you must think of what do they compare in the moment of need your solution with. And who has done that, like you described very well, in the same way as Nespresso, by saying like a perfect cup. And they basically compared it to the price of a coffee in the coffee shop.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Like, if you thought of an alternative universe where Nespresso had, let's say, put all their pods together into a kilo bag, mm-hmm. and then sold those kilo bags on the shelves of a supermarket next to a Illy or a Dow Egberts or a Lavazza, a kilo of Nespresso would be astronomically expensive. It would, I think, be about 100 euros. Now, no one in their right mind is going to push away a 20 euro bag of Lavazza and take home a 100 euro bag of Nespresso. It would feel morally wrong. It looks so expensive. But of course, that's not what Nespresso did. Nespresso served in pods, as Rory Sutherland talks about. A pod gives you a cup size serving. And once people think of cups of coffee, the natural comparison set in their mind, what they start thinking about is barista coffee, Starbucks, Cafe Nero's, Costa Coffee. And suddenly the 60 or 70 cents that Nespresso want for a pod of Lungo coffee, you know, that looks amazing compared to the 3 euros that Starbucks want for a cappuccino. Mm. But that's 70 cents for a pod, 100 euros for a bag. Now, it's exactly the same per gram price. But because you've shifted the mental comparison set, one seems like bargain, one seems like a complete ripoff.
If you listen to this and the economical effect this has, it makes you wonder why some people in the marketing world, even the marketing science world, say behavioral economics have nothing to bring to the table. It sounds really strange. Can you explain that? Like, why?
So I think, and maybe the most well-known critic of behavioral science is probably Byron Sharp.
Byron Sharp, yeah.
And, you know, don't want to put words in his mouth. You know, I think, you know, it probably, you know, worth getting him on to kind of state his case. But from what I've seen on his kind of blog post or his written for magazines about behavioral science, I think he's making a logical error. What he does is identify that some behavioral science experiments don't work. You know, they're
don't
either
replicate.
Fraudulent or don't replicate. Yep. Mm-hmm. And therefore says, well, the entire discipline is flawed. But that, to me, is illogical. I mean, there are papers written by academics in the world of marketing that don't replicate. Now, there are lots of those examples. But just because one study doesn't replicate, it doesn't mean the entire field is debunked. What people should instead do is not think of behavioral science as this single homogenous entity in which all studies are of equal value. You know, you've got a spectrum. What is really robust is when you find studies that have been conducted in very naturalistic settings multiple times. Then you can have very high credibility in those findings. Now, you then go all the way to the other end of the spectrum, and it might be a study that a academic knowingly change the results, maybe to get themselves some fame and TV appearance money. Now, the study straddles that entire continuum. And to get the best out of the field, what you should be doing is focusing on those naturalistic studies where the results have been found again and again and again. That's the studies that marketers should be drawing on, not the kind of bogus findings at the other end.
And something which always impressed me about your work is also that you yourself have reproduced studies. Like you found the evidence in the science, and then you said, okay, let's test this out. Tell us a little bit about that, like how you do it and when you did it.
Absolutely. So when I first became interested in behavioral science, probably slightly naively, you know, I'd come across a paper, I'd rush to see a client and I'd say that this is an amazing study from 1962. And you could see their eyes kind of rolling and thinking, oh my Lord, what has this guy come up with again? And one that sticks in my mind, I went to see a client with a study, I think it was by John Gorville. So he had come up with this idea of the pennies a day effect. So his original experiments, early 90s, he showed that if you ask potential donors to give money to a charity, if you position the donation as £365 per year, you got very few people donating. If you said to them, will you donate £1 a day for a whole year, you got quite a lot of people donating. So his finding was people put too much emphasis on the headline number, the £1 or the £365. They don't put as much emphasis, mistakenly, on the unit of time. So if you want a cost to feel large, you should be talking about that cost over the longest possible time period. If you want to make it feel small and acceptable, break your cost down to the smallest possible time unit. Now, I can remember going to a client with that and saying, this is
1962,
amazing.
Here, listen to this. Next year's strategy is based on this.
And they were like, well, look, this is a charity. You know, we were a car brand or a mobile phone company, whoever they were. You know, what could we possibly learn from this? It's too distant from what we're doing. So they sent me off, and then I thought to myself, well, okay, why don't I try and rerun Gorville's study, but in a more commercial setting? So working with a colleague, I think it was Jenny Riddell, I did a lot of experiments with her, she was absolutely brilliant. We recruited 500 people, and we showed them a picture of a car, a description of that car, and then a price. So I'll simplify it for my maths, but you know, let's say the annual amount was £365 to rent it a year. That would mean that the monthly was £30 a month, weekly £7 a week, daily £1 a day. We then, each participant saw randomly one of those scenarios. So either the yearly price, monthly, weekly, or daily. We then questioned everyone as to what they thought the value of the car was, how good a deal that price was. And we saw this very clear pattern. Just as Gorville found with charities, the shorter the time period, the better value it appeared. So when it was conveyed as a daily price, I think 51% of people thought it was good value. When it was the annual price, it was 11%. So this massive swing in variation. Now that is pretty representative of the studies I've done.
Yeah.
Go out.
And what was the result? Could you convince them with it?
Oh, so with that, the car brand, we used Mazda, but it wasn't actually for the car brand, Mazda themselves. So okay. We just used their imagery as a stimulus for an experiment, but we didn't want to have to go and get their permission. So it was, this is all publicly available data. So it was a mix. Some people, you know, took it on board and loved it. Others were more reticent.
I was just thinking of what you talked about before with this anchoring effect of price, like with comparison. Yeah, like the moment you think of a certain value, for example, the cup at Starbucks, that's anchoring the price of €3.95 in your head. That's what I pay at Starbucks. And suddenly the 50 cents per tap from Nespresso looks different. And that's the anchoring effect. So you could just apply that with a group of people, like 10 or 20 people, and ask them, is the TV tower in Berlin higher or shorter than 500 meters? Yeah. And everybody should write down on their paper what they think, how high it is, because nobody really knows. And then you ask, and then you will see a huge scoot towards a higher number, whereas the actual height is maybe just 180 meters. And then you take another group and ask the same question, as in, do you think it's higher or lower than 100 meters? And then they should write down their estimation. And that's a very simple way of proving that these effects actually work.
Yeah, absolutely. And the kind of original experiments into anchoring were done by Kahneman and Tversky back in 1973. And their argument was, for something like that question about the TV tower, it will vary from a Berliner to a Londoner, you know, but even a Berliner won't know the exact answer, but they will have this zone of reasonable answers. So what happens if you throw out a number like 500? Everyone thinks that's too tall, but they adjust down, and then they stop once they get to the top of their own zone of reasonable answers. So maybe they give a response of 350 meters. Whereas if you say, is it higher or lower than 100 meters, and then ask them what the actual height is, well, they take 100 meters as their starting place. They know that's too low. So they keep on adjusting upwards in their mind until they hit the bottom of that zone of reasonable answers. So you get this strange situation in which, even though everyone knows the initial number is irrelevant, because they take it as the starting place and because they don't adjust far enough, it ends up affecting their responses. Yeah. And that's something...
That's super. That's a great explanation. But that's just something when people are skeptical. Do behavioral science principles actually affect behavior? This is a very simple experiment everybody can do in a boardroom or something.
Absolutely, yeah.
And this brings us back to Red Bull, because by changing also the category, like by not saying we're not a soda, that also left room, that left an empty space. So where's the anchor now? Where's the anchor now?
It's free floating. They could get away with charging this high amount because people weren't comparing it back to cans of Coke or cans of Fanta.
Yeah.
If they'd launched in those squat cylindrical cans, you know, maybe they could have charged a 5% or 10% premium, you know, because it was so full of caffeine. It was, you know, there was an extra functionality, but they would have been tethered back to that benchmark, that anchor.
And that leads me to a topic which I would like to explore in depth here, because many of those principles are very relevant for many things like price setting, product development, and so on. And I would like to focus a lot now on the branding side and the value of distinctiveness, because it's a huge lever. And that's, we can apply it immediately for Red Bull. Obviously, on the shelf, suddenly that small can is distinct. What is the value from the behavioral science perspective of distinctiveness?
I think there's two big values. The first one is what's known as the von Restorff effect, or the isolation effect. And that is the idea that we are hardwired to notice what is distinctive. So the original experiments are German. They go back to the work of Hedwig von Restorff, psychologist at the University of Berlin back in the 1930s. And for her classic study, what she basically did was give people lists of information. So you might get 10 items on a piece of paper, and let's say 9 of those items are one category. They could be from the animal category. So you've got cat, dog, elephant, giraffe. But then sooner or later, she throws in a completely different type of information, a different category. So it might be a piece of furniture. So the next word might be table. And then she might go back to her animals again, goldfish, shark, zebra. And she lets people read through these lists, a couple of minutes. She then takes the lists away and asks people what they can remember. And her finding is that if you give people long lists mainly composed of animals, it'll be the furniture they remember. Whereas if you give them long lists mainly composed of furniture, it will be the distinctive animals that people remember. So that became known as the von Restorff effect. And it is definitely a experiment that is worthwhile applying in marketing, because most ads cling to their category conventions. And von Restorff would say that is a mistake. You're condemning yourself to invisibility. What you really want to do as a marketer is think about your category, think about all the norms of behavior, and then split those behaviors into two buckets. One might be conventions that need to be adhered to. There's a very good reason. The other would be conventions that are just there for tradition's sake. And it's those that you want to be breaking. Because if you do, you're harnessing one of the simplest tactics to get noticed. So I think the first reason to behave distinctively is simply one of noticeability.
Right. And that ties in neatly into what has... I mean, these are experiments from the 30s again. So let's base our brand strategy on the work of von Restorff from the 30s. But then you look at Ehrenberg Bass and they discover, oh, wow, distinctiveness is so powerful because it makes every contact, every touch point work harder for you. People recognize you quicker, memorize you longer. And in category entry points, like in moments of need, suddenly your brand springs to mind more easily. And why is that? Because you've been distinct. And distinctiveness, with the discussion about differentiation, is worth more than differentiation as long as you promise what the category has to offer, you know, because that's what people look for. You know, people look for a car that takes me from A to B, and then they look for the brand according to the context. So I think that's very powerful.
I think definitely very powerful, even in that respect. I think there's another area that marketers should consider distinctiveness, and that's in the moment of product consumption or usership. So what you really want to do is make sure that using your product is highly visible to passers-by. So one of the core themes of behavioral science is that people are a social animal. We are deeply influenced by what others do. So the task as a marketer is to make your product appear popular. Now, sometimes you can just go out and state that you're popular, you know, 1 million users, 2,500 five-star reviews, and that will have an impact. But really what you want to do is make the design of your product so distinctive that people come to their own conclusions about your popularity. So think of a pub example. If someone buys a Gordon's, you know, Gordon's gin and tonic, it's a transparent liquid, it's served over lime like every other gin and tonic. Once that drink has been taken away from the bar, it becomes essentially invisible because it's interchangeable with a Smirnoff or it could be water, absolutely. But now think about what Hendrix did. You know, they did their serve over cucumber. Completely distinctive. So now people take that Hendrix away from the bar, you still spot it very easily. You could make a similar case as I do in the book for Aperol. You know, this bright orange colour makes it easily noticeable, and that means it only takes a few people to drink it, and it feels like the whole pub is imbibing Aperol. Now, that might sound like a massive piece of speculation, but actually there's an awful lot of research for this. So there's a study by Kees Kaiser at the University of Groningen in the Netherlands into this idea of implied social proof. So he finds an alleyway and lots of Dutch people park their bikes there, and crucially there is no litter bin. Now Kaiser goes down to the alleyway early in the morning and he puts flyers for a fictitious sport shop on the handlebars of the bikes. He then wanders off 10, 20 yards and he monitors what do the returning cyclists do. Do they get to their bike, find the flyer and take it home with them like good citizens? Or, and remember there's no bin, do they chuck it on the floor? Mm-hmm. Now, Kaiser sets up this experiment in one of two ways. On some occasions, on some days, he has gone down to that alleyway really early in the morning and he's made it a complete tip. He has spray painted the walls with graffiti. He has chucked rubbish on the floor. He's made it look like the social norm is for people to litter. Now, when he does that, just 69% of people chuck their rubbish on the floor. 69%. On other occasions, he goes down to that alleyway very early in the morning. But this time, he cleans up the alleyway. He paints over all the graffiti. He picks up every single bit of litter there is. He makes it look like the social norm is not to litter. And in that setting, you get just 33% of people littering. So that's a twofold difference in littering based on what people think the norm of behavior is. Kaiser's argument is if you state that your behavior or your products is popular, you might encounter skepticism. But if people come to their own conclusions about what's popular,
this must be popular.
Yeah, who do people trust more than themselves? Yeah. So think about Hendrix or Aperol in that light, and suddenly you see this distinctiveness, I think, has a double benefit.
And we can circle back to our favorite brand, Apple, with the white earphones. That was very distinct, visible from the distance, and you saw more and more of them. And suddenly you were like, oh, you know, he's part of the digital revolution. He has an iPod in his pocket. So it was very visible. Before, you couldn't distinguish if it was a Sony, Iowa, Philips, whatever.
Absolutely. So even if Philips were outselling iPod in the early days 10-1, no one knew that. Because the hardware was in people's pockets. You know, the only thing that was on display if you were listening to a Philips MP3 player was the interchangeable bland black headphones. Mm-hmm.
And if you look at it functionally, you say like, oh, white headphones, that's terrible. They become dirty so quickly. Da, da, da. So all the headphones were black. So they stay neat longer. And that's contraintuitive to say, we're going to make it white. And everybody is going to see it.
So if you were, yes, exactly. If people were, you know, prioritizing cleanliness over other values, it might be a problem. But I think the argument would be, you know, this point that humans are a herd species. And once we see lots of other people using iPods, then we at least consider whether it's right for ourselves.
And now that we talk about it, it's so rich, this topic of distinctiveness, because like another brand that you talk in the book about is Guinness. And Guinness is one of the few beers that actually you can spot from the distance. And even if you see another dark ale like Guinness, you think they drink Guinness because it's so connected. It's the distinctive brand asset of the, you know, this black beer. No other beer is black. And Aperol Spritz is that distinctive color. And that also was at a time when it became popular that suddenly Instagram became really big. So it was a beautiful picture that you could take and show that you live the Italian lifestyle.
Yeah.
And these are more signals that it's socially, you know, like the social group is getting bigger and bigger.
Yeah. And it's the interesting reason about why I think it's important to have the case study and the experiment. Because of course, any brand, they, you know, when they launch, there are so many other things going on. As you say, yes, there's the distinctiveness of the product, but there's also the rise of Instagram. There's also the, you know, the individual taste of that product. There's also the marketing they do. But what Kaiser study is so good at is holding all these other variables the same.
Yeah.
And what it shows very clearly is this perception of how other people are behaving affects our own behavior. And I think the experiment isolates the ingredient that's driving success. The case study is useful to show that it can, that this idea can move from beyond academia into the real world.
Yeah, that's brilliant. It's really good. And it ties back into that study that you already talked about, asking for help when nobody helps you. That's also a social proof effect, because when people are overwhelmed by a decision, what do they look for? They look for security. And so if nobody else is doing anything, I better not do anything, because this seems to be the right behavior.
Absolutely. And that is the dark side, I think, of social proof. Mm-hmm. That yes, you can encourage a desired behavior by emphasizing it's popular, but unfortunately, often people misuse social proof. They emphasize the scale of an unwanted behavior and they make the situation worse. So imagine you're in a marketing agency and you're the financial director and you send out an email saying, you know, to all staff email saying, none of you are filling in your timesheets and it's really bad and it's costing the agency money. You must do it. What negative social proof would suggest is that financial director has just made the situation worse. If you tell everyone, all of your colleagues are misbehaving, what it does is remove a sense of transgression around that misbehavior, and it makes it that misbehavior more likely to occur. So yeah, social proof is a fascinating one in that you've got to be very careful to stress the scale of the behavior you want, not the large scale of the behavior you don't want.
Yeah. So the good thing for the financial director to do is to stress that over 87% of your colleagues fill out their worksheets precise and on time. And that brings in a lot of money for the agency. And so you lazy out there, you better get behind the social norm. Yeah,
And that would be a great way of doing it. And the brilliant thing is with these experiments, they don't mandate one way of doing something.
Yep.
You know, you could take the same experiment and say, okay, well, why don't we isolate and discreetly target the worst half of performers and then say directly to those people, you know, you are filling out your timesheets less regularly than your peers. You know, you can honestly state to the bottom 49% that they are underperforming.
And make their
business that comparison with the peers for the underperformers is a very powerful way of changing their behavior. It's a lovely experiment about that.
We have applied that once for the German rail system. And they wanted to improve their behavior of people using the toilets in the trains, because it's a massive influence on the quality of the riding on a train if you have dirty toilets. So we put these stickers on the mirrors, which basically used that effect. It said like, Ihre Mitreisenden wollen sich wohlfühlen. So the people, there's Mitreisenden is a term in German which says like all your common travelers, yeah? All your other, your common travelers, so creating that group of you are a traveler and you are together in a group of other. They want to feel comfortable. You too? If so, help us keep this toilet clean. And it actually helped improve the cleanliness of the toilets massively, double digits. And we're talking here millions of euros saved in cleaning those toilets.
Oh, fantastic. Fantastic. Yes. I didn't know about that one. That's a lovely example.
Yeah. Yeah, I can send you a picture after the show. It's one of the things that I feel, because I'm usually also in the field of branding and marketing, and this is like public, like influence, public behavior is so thankful, because you think like, wow, this is so great. It improved the world a little bit, that everybody takes more care of each other. And I think that in politics, this should be used much more often. That politicians are more sensitive towards the way they phrase things, to say this is normal now, and this is a tangent I don't want to follow because it's another 3 hours to talk about. But what I see right now is dangerous: the culture of how politicians talk about certain developments, and they break certain barriers, and suddenly it becomes normal to talk about in a more polarizing, less polite way about things, and that changes everybody's behavior.
Yeah. Cialdini, who probably has run the most experiments in this area of social proof, he refers to negative social proof being the government's big mistake. And he points out in America, and it's certainly true in Britain as well, that often the governmental advertising will say things like, lots of youths carry knives, or lots of students are getting drunk, or lots of people aren't turning up to their doctor's appointments. Mm-hmm. Now, these are all very well-meaning messages, but by stressing the scale of that unwanted behaviour, they inadvertently make the situation worse.
We make a follow-up session where we talk about behavioral science in to create better politics. back to branding, in brand management. If brand managers would... are intrigued now. They buy your book, hopefully. I advise everybody to do so. Because you've done also the heavy lifting. And I think you can hear that when you talk. You are so precise. You really went into doing the research, into the original studies. There's really like the body of work that is there has been combed through with a fine comb by you, and then built on that. So this is really a shortcut if you want to apply and practice behavioral science in your field. So if somebody is interested now and wants to start working with behavioral science principles in their marketing and, for example, in their brand management, what would be the best way to go about this, and what tests would they run, and how would they do that?
Yeah. So I, if I was doing my first kind of steps into behavioral science, I would start very, very small scale. I'd focus on a problem that you can measure very easily and you get immediate data back on, and that it costs you nothing to test. So actually, if you're trying to introduce behavioral science into an organization, rather than making grand changes to brand strategy, I'd be thinking, let's have a look at maybe the e-commerce site, and let's apply a tiny little experiment that is costless and will quickly prove its value. So, you know, we talked about temporal reframing, the pennies a day effect. Now, that would be a great thing to test because it doesn't cost you anything. Within a week or two, if you've got a big enough website, you'll see whether it's had an impact. And when I say you'll see it's had an impact, what you need to do is do simple A-B tests. Now, 99% of the people see the price displayed as £30 a month. 1% of people see £30 a month, that's the same as £1 a day. You do a simple test like that, then see whether it works. And I think if it does, then you've got this body of information you can share around the organizations and get people excited about it. So I would start small is my advice.
Oh, that's a very good advice. And which behavioral patterns, you've worked with many large brands, which behavioral patterns do you see universally among those that outperform their peers?
That's a great question. So I would say that I think there are two that come up again and again. Social proof. So that's the point we've been talking about, the fact that if you make your product look like it's popular, it becomes more popular still. It's a very robust finding. In the last 15 years, I've started to create this kind of world map I've got on a PowerPoint. And each time I find a study about social profile, it's the map. And it's at 30 studies over the last 15 years so far across the globe. So there's a real breadth of evidence with social proof. So that would be one place where I'd start. The other one is this principle of make it easy. So there have been two behavioral scientists who've won the Nobel Prize for Economics. So Kahneman in the last 25 years, Kahneman in 2002 and Richard Thaler in 2017. And interestingly, both of them in interviews have said the same thing when they have been asked to identify the single biggest learning from their work. And both of them say, make it easy. Now, that isn't just a statement of the obvious. Their point is not just if you make a behavior easier, it happens more. Their point, and this is the crucial bit, is identifying small bits of friction that are stopping a behavior happening and removing them tends to have an outsized effect. So their argument is people overestimate the importance of increasing appeal for a product or motivation. People underestimate the importance of making purchasing that product slightly easier. So I think of all the experiments, social proof and make it easy, they are the ones that probably could be applied by pretty much any brand on the planet.
And those two are great also on a tactical level, but as well on a strategic level, because you can frame your brand as the market leader, which is always great. Yeah, you just need to define the market, but also as a solution to make your life easier and solve to remove friction from life is also a very strong brand promise. Like many people buy Apple computers because they know, it's so intuitive. I don't have to worry about anything. It's going to just buy it, set it up and it runs. And that's a super powerful motivation. Yeah. Whereas like the freaks that really know how to deal with computers, they I always want a PC. I don't want an Apple. This, you know, I can't get into the second layer of the operating system and change whatever I want to change. But for most people, that's completely irrelevant. It's like, they just want it easy.
Yeah, absolutely. It's an awful lot of the tech brands you see this principle at play. I mean, the one that always fascinates me because of the scale of spend in other areas is Netflix. So Netflix, I think, spend $25 billion a year on content. But one of the best things they've done to increase viewership is to make it easier. Mm-hmm. Now, it used to be, you watch a box set, your episode ends, you had to go and find the remote control to the viewer if you wanted to watch the next program. Now, of course, they've flipped that on their head. Now, when the episode ends, you have to find the remote control if you don't want to watch the next program because there's autoplay.
Yeah.
Now, that's amazing. They've done is shifted effort by a couple of seconds. Yet even in the context of spending $25 billion a year on content, that tiny little removal of friction has had a massive effect on viewership. So absolutely, you look at an awful lot of tech companies and this principle of ease is being used very, very well.
Yeah, that's a great example. As I know that many people listening also in their everyday work, they think about communication. So as a last topic, I would like to pick up on that. For example, Dyson. I love the chapter on Dyson. Would you like to explain what you think? Like there's this design, there's the great, you don't need a bag anymore and all that. As like, but how do they communicate it and what makes it so successful?
So slightly ironic, Lynn, and you'll see why this is ironic in a minute. Dyson is perhaps my favorite chapter in writing the book. And the reason for that is some of the chapters, gosh, they took ages to research the brands. You know, there wasn't a lot of information that was easily findable. So it took absolutely ages to discover interesting insights about the brands. Dyson was complete opposite. Bought the autobiography of James Dyson, mm-hmm. opened it up, very first page, very first line, there was this amazing statement, which is, I spent 4 years making 5,127 prototypes of the bagless vacuum before I created the first working version. And I thought when I read that, wow, that is amazing. That is a masterclass in behavioral science. Because what he's doing is making all the efforts that he went to very, very transparent. He's emphasizing this huge journey to get to the end invention. And that harnesses an idea called the illusion of effort. So one of the earliest experiments was by Andrea Morales, who's at the University of Southern California. And back in 2005, she recruits a group of people who are in market for a house, and she shows them 10 houses that meet their requirements. Now, everyone sees the same list of houses, but the twist in the experiment is some people are told that the estate agent who put the list together took 1 hour to generate the list, and they used a computer. Whereas the other half of participants are told the estate agent took 9 hours to generate the list and they did it manually. But apart from that little cover story, everything else is the same. Everyone gets the same houses. When the participants are asked to rate the quality of the service from this estate agent, they have to do it on this scale of 0 to 100. Morales sees a very interesting pattern. The people who thought the estate agent took 1 hour, they rate the estate agent at 50 out of 100. Whereas the participants who thought the estate agent took 9 hours, they rate the service at 68 out of 100. So even though everyone sees exactly the same list of houses, the people that think lots of effort went into it, they rate the estate agent 36% better. Now, this goes back to Kahneman's point. Kahneman says, when we are faced with a complex question, we tend to replace that complex question with a simpler one that gives us an almost as good answer. And understanding the quality of a service in an estate agent is a complex question. But judging how much effort they've put in, that's something very simple. So people use effort as a proxy for quality. Morales's argument is marketers shouldn't create fictitious stories of effort, you know, but they should be more transparent about the efforts they already go to. Don't expect your audience to realise the efforts unless you are very clear. And that's what Dysons do so brilliantly by always coming back to this 5,127 prototypes point. It's across their PR, it's on their website, it's in all their ads. You know, it's a wonderful way of making the same vacuum that much more appealing.
Isn't that crazy in that way? Because you don't judge what you get from it, but what went into it to get what you get. And that's the reason why when you're a creative or a consultant and you have a great idea very quickly, the biggest mistake you can make is to phrase it out to the client. Oh yeah, I got that solved. Yeah, we can do that. And here's my invoice for $10,000. But that doesn't work. It's like you have to go back into your chamber and come back 4 weeks later and say, you know, I really think that this is the solution. And then, yes, and that is the labor illusion, basically.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, labor illusion, illusion of effort, often used interchangeably. You know, maybe how people should behave is judge the quality of the estate agent's work or the consultant's proposal on its inherent metrics. That's probably what people should do. But behavioral scientists aren't interested in what people should do. They're interested in how they actually behave. And what we actually do, what actually influences us, is this conflation of effort and
quality. But what does it
quality.
Mean, for example, for AI? If you have, I read some studies on people judging things when they knew it was created by AI or by a person. They downgraded the AI-generated solution if they knew it, but most people don't know it. But sometimes it becomes more and more apparent that AI is being used. How would you, from a behavioral science principle, would do that?
So you're absolutely right. There's a wonderful study by Kobe Millett, who's at VR University in Amsterdam, and he shows people a variety of different products. So one of the products is a poster of a skull. And some people are told it's created by a AI robot. Others are told it's hand-drawn. And what he finds is when he asks people their purchase intent, people far, far prefer, the group who see the supposedly hand-drawn poster, their purchase intent is about 61% higher than the people who see the poster being attributed to an AI robot. And Millett's argument is this is all about the illusion of effort. The audience, consumer's assumption is that AI equals low effort. You know, when they go and use ChatGPT, they put in a prompt, they get out a blog post in seconds. They put in a prompt, they get their answer in seconds. We assume AI equals low effort. So there's absolutely a danger of if you are a company, you speed up your processes, pull things together far more quickly with AI, there is a real danger that even if objectively the quality doesn't change, your audience is going to rate it worse.
And the solution to this would be basically to admit that it is AI, but create a frame that to train the AI has taken us 2 billion data points and 3 years of development. And we combined 10 of the leading AI scientists to come up with a solution. And then suddenly you have the effect that we just talked about.
Absolutely. There's a really nice anecdote from, and it's not to do with AI, but I think there's a real parallels. There's an anecdote from the late 90s. I think it was 1998 when Citibank Travelers.
I think you told that one.
Go ahead.
This is a great story. It's fantastic.
And it's a massive banking institution that's created Citigroup. And they hire Paula Scher, who's one of the world's leading designers, to come up with a logo. And they pay her $1.5 million. So today's money, that's about $3 million. In the actual briefing meeting, whilst Citigroup are explaining their objectives, Paula Scher sketches out a logo. And if you Google, you can see pictures of the napkin that she drew it on, and you can see that the logo she drew in the briefing meeting is very similar to the final logo the Citigroup use. And supposedly, when she goes back a few weeks later, maybe a few months later, and hands in her bill for $1.5 million, the clients say to her, look, you know, how in all good faith can you ask for $1.5 million when we actually saw you sketch out the logo in the meeting? It took you 30 seconds. And her answer became absolutely legendary. She said, yes, it took me 30 seconds, but it took me 34 years to learn how to draw it in 30 seconds. And I think how you've just described that solution for AI is very similar to where Paula Scher got to. You've got to draw people's attention away from the speed of delivery to the efforts that went into the creation of your small, large language model.
And again, you just change the context within which you judge, which you just received. Yeah. So if your listeners out there take this away, then this is the one thing, context is king. And you create the context within which your brand is perceived and your decisions are made. Let's look forward. I know that you've been, how many years have you been, the first book was out already?
Oh, first book was 2018, I think.
So you've been almost 10 years intensively, like, toiling away in bringing behavioral science. Did you see progress? Like, do you see more acceptance? Do you see more companies adopting this approach, asking for your help? Do you see like the effectiveness movement in advertising?
Yes, certainly in Britain. Certainly in Britain in marketing. When I first started engaging with companies, most of my time was spent explaining what behavioral science was, persuading them that it might be useful. And then we'd get on to, well, what can we tangibly do to solve this specific problem you have? Now, and of course there's variance between sectors and between companies, but now most marketers in Britain are aware of behavioral science, and it's far more about showing that it can be used to solve their specific problems. That's what most of my time's on, not persuading people of the merits of the field. So I think in Britain, certainly, there is very widespread understanding and acceptance of the field. You know, I still think there's further to go, but we're worlds away from where we were.
I think you're probably a decade ahead of Germany. But that has a lot to do also with the English government has adopted a nudge, Thaler. There was this nudge ministry or something that was created. I don't know if it still exists, but
it still exists. 2010. We had the coalition government, one of our, you know, we very rarely in Britain have coalition government. So it was coalition government of Clegg and Cameron. And they set up a unit called the Behavioural Insights Team, or the Nudge Unit. And they were tasked with trying to make sure governmental campaigns drew on behavioural science. So there's some really lovely examples of them applying behavioural science principles to tax collection and so forth that have had some brilliant results. So I think it was the fact that there were some kind of prominent figures in you know, business applying these principles at the same time as government, it led to led to widespread adoption. And then, of course, businesses, once they see it working, then they want to double down.
What do you hope for in that field? Like,
I think one of the most interesting areas of development is looking at how different biases affect different types of people. So we talked repeatedly about social proof. There's a really nice experiment from a psychologist in America called Wozmeck, who showed that, for example, young people are more effective than old by social proof. And I think that whole area of taking some of these well-known principles and then trying to understand, well, how do they affect the rich versus the poor differently, the young versus the old, the men versus women. I think this personalization and tailoring of which nudges, which behavioral science principles work best amongst which audiences. I think
that would be amazing. I remember this one study which showed that when you target also people that end the end of a decade, like 19, 29, 39, that if you really want them to change, for example, their bank, that's a perfect moment because they reevaluate everything in those moments anyway, because they feel something is ending. Yeah. And there's this magic of something ending or the magic of the beginning. Let's say that's the reason why fitness centers, sports centers sell all the memberships in the beginning of the year, because everybody wants to, okay, I'm going to change my life now.
Yeah, there's a brilliant study. It's Adam Alter and Hal Hirschfeld. And they came up with this idea of nine enders. The people whose age ends in 9, 29, 39, 49, they are far more likely to make big change to their life than other ages. And as you say, they argue that as you approach the turn of a decade, you know, because it has such cultural significance, people start contemplating how their life's going. And it's this act of contemplation that's so important. We step off autopilot and we at least consider alternative ways of behaving. So if, you know, let's say there's some marketers who work for a brewery, if they want people to try a non-alcoholic beer for the first ever time, 39, 49, 59 would be a brilliant age. If there are marketers working at finance companies listening, well, why not think, let's try and get people to make savings for the first time when they're 29, 39 or 49. You know, there are certain, I think, categories where nine enders is a brilliant academic insight that is now very, very practical. You know, loads of different data providers can identify people's age. So absolutely, what a great discrete way of targeting, you know, anyone that you want to make a big change.
And it also, we can widen that even, like identify clusters of people in moments of transition, because those are, for brands, very valuable moments. Because if you think of deep relationships are always forming in moments where you start to study, you go into elementary school, you start a sports, there's something new happening, yeah? And then suddenly there's a chance of new relationships, new feelings about things, and that would tie in very nicely to this kind of research that you just described.
Yeah, absolutely. Back in 2017, I did a really simple experiment. So it's 2,370 people, sent them a survey, raft of different questions. Only two of them mattered. The first one, and I said, have you undergone any of these life events in the last 12 months? And I gave them a list. So have you got married, divorced, retired, moved house? And people would tick the ones that applied. Filler question to put them off the scent. And then the final question was, in the categories below, have you, you know, tried a new brand in the last 12 months? Or have you got a new favorite brand in the last 12 months? And I gave them 8 or 9 different categories, like perfume or lager or coffee shops. And when I crossed the two bits of data, I saw a very clear pattern. People who had undergone a life event in the last 12 months were 2.5 times more likely to have tried new brands on average in all those categories. So you are absolutely right. You have these windows of opportunity. When someone undergoes one big change in their life, all sorts of unrelated behaviors change. So that is a great moment to be targeting people. If you have a group of people who aren't behaving the way that you want, maybe they shop with a competitor or they're not using all your services, when they undergo a life event, you've got this kind of year or so window in which their behavior is a little bit more malleable.
And our listeners are going to experience a change in their life as well, because this podcast is going to end. So now is the moment to change something. And so if you want to send them a message, what they should change, like you have the chance to put for 1 year on all their laptops and PCs and in the morning on their phone, like a screensaver, which gives them an impulse. What would be that impulse be?
Oh, that's a great question. I think I would come back to one of the core ideas, which is beware claimed data. Now, beware what people tell you and prioritize experiments instead. And I think if people do that, then everything else will fall into place.
Okay, beware of claimed data and look at how people behave.
Use experiments. So
use experiments.
Simple test and control experiments. Okay. That's the way to get to the
truth.
Can
I suggest to make that catchy?
By saying, just beware claimed data.
Look at their mouth, look at their feet. But it's not from me.
Oh, I like that.
I think the Americans say that. Don't look at the mouth. Look at their feet.
I've never heard that. That's really nice.
Translates what you just described.
Yeah. I like that a lot.
So we put that on the screensaver. Yeah. Don't look at their mouth. Look at their feet. Yeah. Great, Richard. This was fantastically rich conversation. Like all your books, I can only advise all you out there to buy all three, not only the last ones.
Fantastic.
Thank you for the great work you're doing. You're bridging really the gap between science and marketing practice. And we need more of your kind. In the name of my listeners, a sincere thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Und das war eine weitere Episode von Markenkraft. Vielen Dank, dass Sie dabei waren. Wir hoffen, es hat Ihnen genauso viel Freude gemacht wie uns. Wenn ja, empfehlen Sie uns, Ihren Freunden, Ihren Bekannten, Ihren Kollegen und bewerten Sie uns auf iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, SoundCloud, egal wo Sie diesen Podcast hören. Share the love for brands. Machen Sie es gut für sich und die Menschen in Ihrem Leben.